Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we need to inform you that The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a riveting, in the sense of very painful.
Yes, riveting, you're getting hot steel or aluminum plunged through to fasten you onto something.
Right. A riveting radio program on this Saturday, the 16th of June. Or, well, it's also, besides being that, it's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm which has registered that as a trademark, and we need to disclose it.
So, yeah.
In Salado, Texas. Registered with the SEC that neither approves nor disapproves, but does regulate them.
Yes.
And let's see, that the information that we use on this program has been obtained from sources we believe to be reliable and accurate and consistently proven to be so, but we don't make any guarantees or warranties, whatever the difference is between a guarantee and a warranty. Let's see here. The stuff we talk about on this radio program should not be construed, considered, or otherwise thought of as investment advice. It isn't. Don't invest on it.
This is educational in nature. It should give you lots of information that you can use to invest.
Yep.
But it is not advice because we don't know you individually, unless we do. And then we have an individual relationship, but we wouldn't be giving you individual relationship advice the air.
And we can throw another disclaimer in there. This is, stocks may be higher or lower when purchased than when sold.
Yes. And
past performance is no guarantee of future returns.
I'll tell you that stocks kept on the higher shelf tend to be higher when sold than when
purchased. All depends on if you take them off the shelf when you sell them.
Yeah. That's true. If you're purchased as is, then...
You know, they do keep stocks on the shelf in companies.
Yeah, it's
a metaphorical
street
shelf.
Name. There's no shelves and no stocks. They're all stuck in a computer somewhere.
So what happened during the week? Let's see. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, which we don't normally talk about, was up a little bit. Was up 0.89%. The S&P 500 was up
2%. 0.2%.
Yeah. The year-to-date, the S&P 500 is up 3.97, which is, we're approaching the six-month point, so it's roughly, for half a year, it's up almost 4%. So it's appreciating, it's growing so far at an annualized rate of about 8%, which is not half bad, but
pretty decent.
Not as good as it has been. It's 12 months ago to today, the S&P 500, which, by the way, is an index into which you cannot directly invest, is up 14.24%, closed out at 2779.66. The big news is, though, that it did next to nothing during a week when so much happened that could have propelled it up or down.
Right. There was a lot of news this week.
So, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, I misstated it, actually dropped 0.89%.
Okay.
And the reason is, and this is one of the things that's amazing, that the S&P 500 didn't move any more than it did. It dropped 0.89% because there are a lot of companies in the Dow, the big companies, that would be dramatically affected by tariffs. It's that simple.
Yeah.
And there's fewer companies as a percentage of the value in the S&P 500 that would be affected by tariffs. So the big news, and we're going to talk about that, I'm sure, is that the trade war is on.
It is on.
And it won't be till July 7th that there's some tariffs already in place.
Well, we have tariffs in place on a large number of countries already.
Uh-huh.
The answering tariffs are coming into place starting July 1 for the Canadians, July 7th for the Chinese, and the Europeans, I believe they're talking about somewhere in the middle of that. I don't remember exactly the date. But we're talking about a lot of countries will be levying tariffs against us in the coming month.
So and the people that at least I've heard quoted in news programs are taking a wait-and-see attitude to see if it actually happens before they get too upset about it. But
the thing is that they took that same approach to our threatened tariffs that did wait and see, and they actually happened.
Well, we've got some that haven't happened yet. They go into effect, the additional round of tariffs against China go into effect.
We've already gotten a series of tariffs that have gone into effect, the 25% on steel.
Well, the issue from what I've heard is the tariffs that have been threatened at this point and announced by people against U.S. goods have not gone into effect yet. And when they go into effect, that's when it'll be hurt. For instance, soybean farmers, we have a record. There's a record quantity of soybeans planted in the United States. And if China puts in, most of that is being sold to China. China uses a lot of soy for a lot of things, and they have been our number one soybean customer. And farmers planted a lot of soybeans. Matter of fact, many farmers, that's all they planted. And it looks like China, if the tariffs go into effect, China will probably turn elsewhere for the soybeans, which means the farmers won't be able to sell the soybeans.
Well, they will. It'd just be extremely, extremely low prices. So expect low prices for soybeans as we see high prices for anything imported. This is kind of what we should expect as long as there's a trade war going on, is that some items will become extremely inexpensive and put the people out of business that grew or made them, and some items will be very expensive with the same result, putting people out of business that made them. So that's where we are. This is, you know, we talked about this week. Consumer durable goods orders are down. They came out, the numbers for May, and this is one of those things that we've been crowing about, the durable goods orders for consumers being up as a major improvement signal for the economy. When we talk about durable goods, that's any good that's made to last for a while that you don't expect to replace in the next year or two. So if you think of a dishwasher, washing machine, refrigerators, that sort of thing, you're not buying a new one every week. This is a long-term purchase, and you want to generally get something fairly nice. You're upgrading generally from what you had before. Those orders are down. They had been up for quite some time. We could look at that and say that's a bad signal for the economy, except that we've got another scenario going on here, and that is that some of the first tariffs that were put in place were put in against washing machines from South Korea. And that's a durable goods order. And what it's done is it's raised the price of all washing machines, not just South Korean washing machines. There aren't enough American-made washing machines to go around. If the prices go up on the South Korean washing machines, then the prices have to go up with supply and demand. There's not enough to go around on the American products. So that doesn't cause more profits to the American manufacturer of washing machines, it causes people to buy fewer washing machines. So that's where we are when I see durable goods orders for consumers down in May. We're starting to see the effect of trade war. And I'm not saying this with an opinion one way or the other about it. This is just when I look at what's going on. This is the answer to that. If we quote to you leading indicators, and we mentioned that a leading indicator is having some difficulty, we want to tell you why that is. And it is a precursor to a slowdown in the economy. That's why they call them leading indicators. So keep that in mind. We are in fantastic shape. What did we say in the newsletter? We may be having a 4% GDP growth rate for the quarter.
Right.
That's fantastic.
We also broke another record. It was announced.
Did we buy it?
No.
If you break it, you buy it.
We broke a record for the amount of money borrowed by the federal government in any given quarter.
Yeah.
$488 billion.
I guess we did buy it.
Which is almost half a trillion. And they said it
in one quarter.
In one quarter. So we now have a record-breaking. Now, it's supposed to come down in the second quarter to about $75 billion.
Oh, that's all.
Right, and then it'll go back up again in the third and fourth quarters. But it's a record-breaking financial news.
Yeah.
It's some interesting things, and we've said this before.
What we can tell you from that directly is that that's going to cause long-term interest rates to go up. particularly when you consider that the Europeans and the Japanese are stopping their purchase programs this year at the end of the year, a purchase of long-term bonds.
The and the fact that what's going on in the economy right now is certainly to us geeks fascinating, and it is an excellent experiment. The federal government is basically borrowing.
Wait a minute. I wouldn't consider myself a geek. I'm a nerd. This is a whole geek.
There's a
business.
Difference.
I believe there is. I don't like the word geek. It just doesn't sound as nice to me as nerd. So
yeah,
that's
but
the difference.
Isn't there a scripture, the geek shall inherit the earth?
Something like that. Yeah, I think it's coming true.
Yeah. Anyway, and I've lost my train of thought there.
Sorry, we're geeks. We're talking about the numbers.
What's happening in the economy right now, and it's a great experiment to see how well it works, is the economy is pretty much running at full tilt or close to full tilt. Unemployment, for instance, in Texas is down below 3%. It's 2.8%. In Texas, it's below 2% in some places in Texas. The overall unemployment in the United States is 3.8%. We have more job openings than we have people looking for work. And in that environment, to stimulate the economy by lowering taxes and then increasing government spending. Now, that increasing, and the president said it, and the members of Congress who were leading the charge to do both those items said it. This isn't my opinion. The objective was to create more jobs, but we already have more jobs than we have people to fill them. And it's going to be a very interesting experiment to see what happens next. Economics, science, the science of economics, if there is such a thing, says that what we should see is an acceleration of inflation as the year goes by, because there's more money to spend
for the same items.
And we should see competition for workers. We should see wages go up. I guess that's good, except for the fact that is inflationary because their productivity is not going up.
Yeah. No, let me explain that for a moment.
Okay.
Just a second. If you just imagine yourself as the owner of a company, and some of you it's not that hard to imagine because you are the owners of companies. You are creating some item that you are selling. You have a specific number of employees that have been fairly well trained over the years to do what they're doing. You have had lots of extra orders come in, so you want to hire more people so that you can build more of these widgets, whatever the widget might be, the cog, the widget, the thing that you're making. So you start looking around to hire someone, and you put an ad out in each of the online publications and the newspaper and Craigslist. And unlike 5 years ago when you would be buried in resumes, you get no response. Or the response that you get is from somebody who cannot function in that job position, either through language or unable to use the machinery or something. So you say, well, I better raise the pay. Well, if you do that and you already have employees and they see that you're raising the pay of someone coming in, there's this tendency for them to say, hey, wait a minute, you need to raise our pay too, because we're looking in the newspaper and there's a lot of people looking for hiring people. And so in order to afford to pay these people the higher wages, the new people and the existing people, which we're seeing in the numbers are showing that wages are going up. You got to raise the price of the widget when you sell it, which causes inflation. Because if everyone is doing this, prices for the same item without added value are going up. That is the definition of what inflation is. When you raise prices on an item that was accepted as a fair price before, and it's happening as a trend across a region or nation, that's inflation.
And inflation is coming back pretty healthily. We kind of get numb to these numbers, but...
Numb numbers?
Yes, we don't pay a lot of attention. I mean, as a public, we don't pay a lot of attention to them until they start biting. But a couple of years ago, inflation was running about 1.1%. Now it's running 2.8%. And it is apparently accelerating. If we look at the underlying producer price index, the and the commodities price index, which is the amount of money that manufacturers and companies in general have to pay to produce something. That's rising at between 3 and 4% a year, and that has to get pushed through into prices at some point, or the companies go out of business. So it's pretty reasonable to say that 2.8% year over year is a lot of inflation. Now, if we take a shorter-term period, if we look at the last quarter or so, inflation is rising at about 3.3%, which is triple what it was a couple of years ago. So far, economic theory is holding together. We have a lot of demand increasing. But the other side of this is we're starting to hit the limitations on our ability to produce supply. In other words, right. If we can't produce stuff
fast enough
for people to buy, then they start bidding up the prices on the things, and that's where inflation comes from.
Or transfer it from one place to another fast enough. If you know, just as a really easy example for those of you that remember it, the Beanie Baby craze or the Cabbage Patch Kid craze. The prices around Christmas went through the roof because they didn't have enough to go around, and they'd done it intentionally. So a limited supply, when there's an existing demand, if the demand hasn't changed and you have a lower supply, prices go up. If the demand goes up and the supply doesn't, prices go up. Just expect that to happen as more of the norm. It's not going to be, I'm going to wait for Christmas sales anymore. It's going to be, I better get this because it's a good deal now, and I'll hold it till December to give it as Christmas gift.
So what we're seeing in more and more, at least this is Jeff, I'm reaching a conclusion, that this year is about as good as it's going to get, and it's going to be really good this year. We're going to see substantial economic growth this year, and then at some point we're going to start hitting the wall. Now, the Fed announced that instead of raising their rates three times this year, they met this week, by the way, and raised their rates to 2%, and actually technically 1.75 to 2, that they will raise their rates four times this year and anticipate three times next year, which will take the rates up to 3.5, which is a pretty significant number. We got a caller. We'll talk about that number in just a minute. We got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was going to ask you a question. With all these years of experience that you've had investing people's money, have you ever had a downfall and people's lost their money? You have a good day, sir.
Where people have lost their money, to the best of my knowledge, no.
Let's explain this a little bit.
But I wanted to a simple answer is prices in the market go up and down.
Yeah,
and if somebody in a down market like in 2002 or 2009 decides to sell out, they will probably have less money than when they bought in. But although
in some cases they held it long enough that they were still in a gain, just not as high a gain as they had been.
But in the sense of lost their money and that we recommended some investment that went belly up and they lost their money, that's an unequivocal no.
Yeah. Let's explain what is a loss. There's multiple ways in investing that you can lose. So as an example, if someone is a business owner, they're much more familiar with loss as a whole than someone with a diversified portfolio. If anyone is a business owner and they purchase a business from someone, and then they take over the business and realize that there is no way that this business will ever make a profit, or they work really hard and they hire a lot of people and they just cannot make the profit come in. At some point, they've got to cut the loss or they've got to completely redesign the business.
Or just write it off.
If you write it off, that's lost money.
Mm-hmm.
In a diversified market portfolio, the whole idea behind diversification is that, number one, companies fail. Union Carbide failed. There are probably a great number of Enron. And what we say here is you got to recognize that companies fail when you're investing. And no matter how good the company is, you got to know that at some point there are risks that could cause the failure of that company that have nothing to do with anything that you can control or even research.
There's only a handful of company out of the many thousands of stocks out there. There's only a handful of them, maybe five or six, that have been around for 100 years.
So it's possible to lose all your money in the market. It's also possible to lose more than all of your money in the market if you go into debt to buy it. Now, these are all things that we
avoid.
On generalities, recommend strongly against going into debt to fund your investments, being concentrated in one stock or one investment. We look at that as way too much risk. And we've got another call on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. There was a huge merger this week in the entertainment communications field. Can you, to the best of your ability, kind of explain who evaluates that, approves it, at least at the government level? I guess the concern is monopoly and fair trade.
3 minute stations.
All
3
right.
minutes to
Thank
your next
you very much
Fox
for the
News
call.
30:30.
And that's Looks my like fault with that 3 minutes.
Three
thing.
Minutes
Sorry
to
about
30:30.
Okay. The Justice Department is in charge of the, I'll use the same words, the monopoly laws. You have a point. You're pregnant with thought. Please give birth.
It's not a monopoly issue, actually. There are two organizations here. One is a distributor. One is a creator of entertainment.
Well, let's go to the general first, because he said who
right.
evaluates this. And what are they evaluating for? So these are the antitrust laws. So go ahead. Well, this is kind of
you know, the Justice Department, there's a series of laws that says that were enacted actually in many cases in the late 19th century and then early 20th century to keep one company from taking over an entire market and price fixing.
U.S. Steel was the example that they used at the time. Carnegie right. basically owned all of the steel manufacturing capability of the world.
So... Well, at least in the United States.
Which was the main supplier for the world. And he owned a lot in Italy and Africa. He owned the vast majority of steel capability for the world.
And the Justice Department can step in if they see that a monopoly is being developed. Microsoft at one point was about to be a monopoly. And because Apple was about to go out of business and Microsoft stepped in and bought a bunch of Apple stock.
No. Microsoft didn't. Bill Gates did.
Oh, Bill Gates.
Bill Gates bought $100 million worth of unvoting shares in Apple.
Just so Apple wouldn't go bankrupt.
Right. And
he basically gave $100 million to Apple.
Right.
Which, by the way,
why would you buy unvoting shares? So.
But, well, because they appreciated later on.
They sure did.
Part of why he's one of the richest men in the world today, because he bought his competitor shares. But that was to prevent Microsoft from being broken up by the Justice Department for creating a monopoly.
So the AT&T is very familiar with the whole breakup rules. It was part of Ma
yeah.
Bell at one point.
And so the issue is that in this particular case, there was some question as to whether it would happen, but the bottom line to it, AT&T does not create entertainment. It only distributes it. And I forgot who they merged with.
Time Warner.
Time Warner.
Well,
doesn't...
wait, let's use the full name, AOL Time Warner.
AOL Time Warner does very little distributing and a tremendous amount of creating of entertainment product. So that's called a vertical integration, and that's a very common thing in today's in the industry of any kind around the world today. Vertical integration makes for some tremendous efficiencies, and as long as the vertical integration doesn't exclude somebody else from doing it, for instance, 21st Century Fox is also producing, or is it 20th or 21st? Anyway, Fox.
Fox is producing. They have content
and
networks.
They're busy trying to be sold to somebody, and there's bids on that. And again, what we're seeing is more and more of a vertical integration. And automobile industry is a prime example of vertical integration. You've
right.
got the companies that make automobiles, owning, in many cases, the companies that sell the automobiles.
Let me kind of come at this from a different direction, because we're talking about the concept of it, and it's important to understand something called the company maturation cycle. It's when is a company mature? And you use the auto industry, because it's fantastic. At the early 1920s, there were 8 or 9 auto companies in the United States. By the 1940s, there were hundreds of them. Fast forward to 2007, 2003, there were 3 major companies in the United States, and by saying major companies, there was no other company out there that was making automobiles and selling them in the United States except for foreign companies. That was it. We went from hundreds and hundreds of companies to 3. Because as companies mature, as a technology matures, the more successful tend to buy the less successful, or the less successful just goes out of business. This is a normal feature of taking a new technology that anybody that innovates can be ahead of anybody else, to over the years really refining that technology down to a point where it's hard to get any new innovation that doesn't cost a lot of money. So other people can compare this to when the EPA puts overbearing standards on coal plants. If, you know, over the years we've said you've got to clean 90% of the pollutants out, and then we said, all right, now you got to clean 95% of the pollutants out, and now you got to do 99% of the pollutants out. It went from 98 to 99. The last 2% of refining the technology costs more than the rest of the 98% put together. So when you've got a mature technology that you have refined and refined and refined and refined, you've innovated as much as you can. This could be another reference to the tube technology that we used in televisions. At some point, you could not make a tube more efficient with the technology that existed. We just couldn't make it more efficient. We had to go to a different technology. This is why Tesla is coming in now. They went to a different technology. They're able to compete because any innovation is better than none. So antitrust is really there from the beginning. The reason why the antitrust laws existed was to prevent the encapsulation of all innovation. Now, we use it when all the innovation's kind of been refined out of the system and we've got a mature system and they're taking over all the others. We say, hey, there's got to be more than one company. Don't tell that to Facebook, just as a side note. I could get into long issue on that. So antitrust is to make sure that we have capitalism, that make sure that we have competition. Will AT&T merged with Time Warner have healthy competition? That's the first question that needs to be asked when we're talking antitrust. And the answer to that is a pretty unequivocal yes. They will have competition in the cable world. They will have competition in the telephone world. It's pretty clear that competition exists on all fronts for them.
Now, if you happen to have internet that's delivered through AT&T, now that net neutrality is officially gone, you may discover that the Time Warner programs come over much faster and much more consistently than the other ones do.
Right, right. But it's very much like what, you know, this is important to understand. Google's been hit a few times with antitrust laws, hit hard. Now, they're not prosecuted by the Justice Department. You got to understand that. This case against Google was not prosecuted by the Justice Department. It came through lawsuits from other search providers and from other map providers saying, hey, when you put in a Google search for maps, the first search term is always Google Maps. That's not fair.
The fact that its algorithm says the most used one is
right.
The one that's going to
come first. They may be using the same algorithm for all their other searches, but if their own advertisement comes up first, then they're using their clout in one field to influence another. Google may be pretty close to antitrust as far as their search and advertisements on the internet, if it weren't for Apple. So,
yeah, well, you know, I noticed that when I search in my iPhone for something and I want to see the map, it's not Google's
Right.
That chimes up.
And they're allowed to do that because Google's got a bigger market share. So you're allowed to have non-competitive practices as long as your competitor is bigger than you are. As soon as you get bigger than everybody else, you're not allowed to. That's what the law says. And so it's important. It's a good law. We don't want to have a marketplace being dictated by one entity, no matter if that's the government or a corporation. We don't want that. That's the opposite of how we do business. Okay.
Well, telephone number in here. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400.
And I'm going to wade into something that is a little out of character for us. Hopefully that's perked up all the ears out there. And that is, I'm going to start at the beginning here. Those that listen to this program know that we are big proponents of the law being followed and that the laws need to be enforced across the board. If there's a law on the books that needs to be enforced, then you will hear us say on the other side of that, if there's a law that's being broken by a lot of people repetitively by otherwise law-abiding citizens, then we've got to look at it and say, we better reform that law. Because if you use the highway as an example, highway engineers, Department of Transportation experts all say when you set a speed limit for a given location, you use the 85th percentile. You track cars going through there when there's no speed limit marked, and you see if 85% of them are going right around 50 miles an hour, that's a pretty good number to use as your speed limit. You're always going to have people going too slow. The real danger is people going way too fast. The only way you can get the dangerous people off the road is to make sure that not everybody is breaking the law. If everybody's breaking the law and they think they're being safe in breaking the law, then you got to arrest everybody. So when you come into
that would be like North Korea.
Right. So the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. I grew up during that law. I learned to drive during that law. It was changed after I'd been driving for quite a few years. And my experience at that point was nobody drove 55 miles an hour. People said you could drive 5, 10, 15 miles above it, depending on what's going on. And it made lawbreakers of just about everybody. My mother broke that law. My mother is a hospital chaplain. And you got to look at the law and you got to say there's something fundamentally wrong with that law. And we recognized it. It wasn't done based on the reality of a situation. It was done as a panic from an outside threat.
Do you remember who instituted the law?
I don't. I know why it was instituted.
It was Richard Milhouse Nixon.
It was
on executive order.
And it was instituted and then followed up by Congress. Mm-hmm. Congress passed it into law because the people in the Middle East, we're embargoing us. It's another way of saying a full-on 100% tariff. They were saying, we're not going to send you any oil. That is...
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's extreme. So we had a law that was on the books for decades after the cause for the law without regard to what actually was going on there. So where am I going with this? Immigration is one of those laws that we're all violating. You just take a moment, recognize that I'm talking about every one of us as citizens. If we do business in the United States, if you go to a hotel, if you have your yard mowed, if you basically any aspect of what you do, if you eat at a restaurant, you either are or have supported illegal immigration. That means that you are violating the law, because this is the same kind of concept as if you're buying stolen goods. You may not know it at the moment, but if you're creating the marketplace for those stolen goods, that's illegal. You're not allowed to buy stolen goods. When you have a law that cannot be followed by U.S. citizens, there's something wrong with the law. So approaching it and saying, we've got to make sure that this law is followed. I'm all for that. Let's figure out how we can make sure that this law is followed, that the people that are violating the law are being punished appropriately. This law that's being violated is a Class C misdemeanor. That is the same as a parking ticket or jaywalking or a speeding ticket. If someone jaywalks and they get a ticket and they refuse to give their ID or they refuse to say that they're going to show up in court, they're allowed to be arrested on the spot. They can be arrested. That's not a problem. It's written into the law. It's a Class C misdemeanor, but it's only the preferred method to take it through civil court. If they say they're not going to show up at court, then they're in violation far enough that they need to go to jail. If someone is arrested 15 times for jaywalking on the same spot, they've been given fine after fine after fine after fine, they started to get some jail time in here, and they're still being arrested, giving them 8 years in jail for jaywalking is not going to prevent people from jaywalking there. You got to look at something else. What is that person wearing? If they're in a valet uniform and they're parking cars and they've been getting tickets and now they are serving their first jail time, we got to look at something else. There's a business practice that is the root of this violation. That this person may be being told, you're not going to get paid unless you cross this street right here. That's a different level that we need to look at if we want that jaywalking situation taken care of. So just to lay that out there, I believe it's important that if somebody's jaywalking repeatedly, they need to stop jaywalking. We got to figure this out. If that means putting them in jail, that means putting them in jail. I'm okay with that. If they're jaywalking with their kids, that's dangerous. Maybe they need to be separated from their kids. Usually that's not what happens. If somebody says, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know there was a crosswalk, they're usually not even ticketed. It's a Class C misdemeanor. If they are ticketed, that's fine. But if you take those kids away from them without telling them when they're going to have their kids back, I think we would all agree that the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Coming back to immigration, we have for many decades held on the books an interpretation of the asylum-seeking law where people in El Salvador and in Guatemala, in places where they're in fear for their life, they go to the U.S. Embassy in those countries, and they're told by the U.S. Embassy, travel north, cross the border at a border checkpoint, turn yourself in immediately to Border Patrol and say that you're seeking asylum. So they start a month-long journey with their children to bring them out of harm's way. And this is something we've held on the books for decades in the United States. They get here, they cross the border, they immediately turn themselves into Border Patrol. They're saying they're seeking asylum. They're arrested and their kids are taken away from them. Their kids are sent away sometimes under the pretext of we're going to take them away for a bath and then not returned. So put yourself for a moment in those shoes of you've been told by an embassy from the United States that you should go and follow these instructions. While you were traveling, an interpretation internal to the Justice Department without any big fanfare was changed to say asylum no longer is someone in fear of their life based on crime. It must be governmental. It takes a long time to get from Guatemala on foot to the United States. And they were listening to our embassy staff saying this is the law of the United States. The punishment doesn't fit the crime because there wasn't a crime. Illegal immigration is technically coming across the border without a visa, except that we have specifically written in, unless you're looking for asylum, we just changed the definition of what they could do that for. We have thousands of kids being separated from their parents. I have a 3-year-old daughter. If I was telling her, I'm taking you to a place that is going to be better for our family and they're going to pay us to be there, because go back to that valet. Go back to the concept of if you go to a hotel, you're paying for illegal immigrations. We are paying because we don't have enough people to fill the jobs. We are paying illegal immigrants to come here, and we're arresting them in the same thing. There are better ways of enforcing this law that will actually work. If we're using children, three-year-olds, two-year-olds, breastfeeding children, being taken from their parents as an example, well, then it's not an example to the immigrants because they don't have the internet. They're not walking around with smartphones. When they are walking across Central America to get to the United States, they don't have access to the internet. This is not making an example to the immigrants. That's not going to stop the flow. It's making an example to people in Congress to say, this is what I'm going to do unless you follow my wishes.
By the way, the Department of Homeland Security officially said this was on Friday, that from April 19th to May 31st, 1,995 children from 1,940 adults have been separated officially.
So that being said, those numbers ended at the end of May. We've mm-hmm. had 16 days now of June, which means if you look at that again, a third more than that now of each of these children, and again, I'm going back to a two-year-old or a three-year-old, there is no way that they understand what's going on here. They cannot understand what's going on here. Even if we're speaking to them in the language of their birth, they still cannot understand what's going on here. I'm going to use a couple of other examples here. Your in-laws and my aunt and uncle, several sets of aunts and uncle, have been missionaries over the years, and some of them in Guatemala. They inspired a lot of children. They ran orphanages and schools in those countries. They inspired a lot of children to innovate, to educate. Some of those kids came here to the United States because we're the shining city on the hill. I am all for looking at immigration and saying, let's make sure we do it in a legal fashion. I'm all for saying, let's approach this as a law that we want to be obeyed. We've got to approach laws with reason. If we find that a huge proportion of American businesses are knowingly hiring illegal immigrants, we've got to change some focus here. We've got to look at the companies that are doing it and saying, you're knowingly hiring these illegal immigrants. That's wrong. We're not taking their kids away from them. What we can do from a beginning standpoint is completely change the way we look at immigration. If we do a survey and we say, how many jobs do we need in a given avocado industry in a given state without taking or adversely affecting American jobs? Well, we've got those surveys. They're pretty accurate. And if we then said, this is how many immigrants that we need in this grouping. In order to get an immigrant to work here, you need to put a listing through a State Department visa program. They apply for those jobs. They get the jobs. You must account for them while they're present. This isn't hard stuff. We've got computers. If we can do our taxes, we can account for immigration if we do it the right way. If we say, all right, we're done with the avocado fields, then there should be, paid for by the businesses, buses sitting there waiting to take the people back to where they need to come. Or if not, they need to have properly registered at another job location. This is something we can do. To say that the only way to stop illegal immigration is to take children away from parents. Now, I've got to say this from a different perspective. There is no other nation on the planet treating refugees like this. That includes Russia. It includes Turkey. When they have Muslim immigrants that may or may not have ISIS in their midst, we're taking Christian families and using biblical passages from the Christian Bible as the excuse to do it. If you can put yourself back 10 years and think if somebody had told you 10 years ago that there were tent camps being set up in the desert in Texas during summer to house children who had been taken from their parents, you would think this was some kind of dystopian science fiction. I'm all for the debate on tariffs. It's a grand experiment. I'm all for looking at how do we reform immigration. I'll even talk deeply about whether or not the wall is a good idea. It may just be a political stunt. Will it stop immigration? I don't know. I doubt it. But, you know, we can talk about that. We've just stepped into a role that is the opposite of everything I grew up understanding America to be. We're the good guys. We go to other nations. We sit and look at them and say, you are mistreating people. Stop it. We're the ones that released the concentration camps. Now, we had some on our soil, but we were very careful about how we treated American citizens even then. These aren't American citizens. And I'm hoping that my monologue here is going to allow people to do their own research. Don't take my word for it. Look and see what's happening and make sure. This is the most important part of it. I don't care if it's a Democrat law, a Republican law. I don't care. For a law to work, the punishment must fit the crime. If it does not fit the crime, then the law is wrong. So we need to do something. I've already done my part, and I'm continuing to do my part. It's not going to be done until we're not housing children in abandoned Walmarts with dogs barking at them.
By the way, somebody has a defense. President Trump defended his actions, and Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, defended the actions of separating families, said they had no choice, although it is a new policy. I'm interested in somebody who would be willing to call and explain why they think it's important. And let's use an extreme example, to take a three-year-old away from their parents without their permission.
It's not an extreme example. It's happening.
It's happening, but there's many other children being taken away as well. I'm just simply saying, let's just use a specific example. And, you know, the American Council of Pediatrics had said that irreparable harm is being done to these children by separating them from their parents, particularly in these circumstances. And
every major religious organization United States is against this.
I'm sure we have people out there who support the president, who support his policies.
And I support many of his policies.
And could possibly find some justification for this. I mean, obviously, Attorney General Sessions found a justification. And I'm curious if anybody would be willing to call and give us some enlightenment on this, why it's a good idea. I mean, I heard the argument from Jeff Sessions. He says you can't prosecute the children, so we need to separate the children from the parents, prosecute the parents, and then kick them out of the United States. Well, there's this little problem. If you can't prosecute the children and you separate them from their parents and you kick the parents out of the United States, that's interesting. Also, the president did state on Friday that this is a negotiating tactic, that he will be glad to stop the policy if he gets a bill passed by Congress that he likes concerning immigration.
Let me say clearly. The president said that taking children from their parents was a negotiating tactic.
Well, he said...
That's the clear statement of the meaning and intent that was said there.
Well, he didn't use those exact words.
No.
He simply said that he would stop doing it if he got a bill through Congress that he liked. By the way, the bill through Congress that he likes does not forbid the separating of children from parents.
And let me be clear here. In law-breaking situations, separating children from parents for their best interest is absolutely a vital piece of any law in any nation. If there are meth addicts with kids, we don't want those kids with the meth addicts. And we're about out of time for this hour. We got to play some commercials and we'll be right back. This subject's not done. It's not our normal conversation, but I'm not going to sit quietly while this is going on. This is un-American. This is the definition of un-American for me. And we'll play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call in here, the phone number is 254-773-1400.
Mm-hmm.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here for the few minutes we have left, very
this
few
hour. This
minutes
hour.
We have left this hour, is 254-773-1400.
Yeah. We've got a lot of other things to talk about in the economy. I'm glad that I had the opportunity to have that conversation right there, or monologue at least.
I would recommend, if you, we haven't been exactly bombarded with calls defending the practice.
No.
Presuming that there's anyone listening, at the very minimum, I think you should contact John Carter. You can go on the internet and just type in Representative John Carter, and you'll wind up at his website, and you can email him on there. And if you're in his district, it'll receive it. I tried to call yesterday, and I got a recording that said, "Honorable John Carter, not answering. Click. Mailbox full. Click."
So, and he's getting a lot of conversation, but is it, you know, so much of this, you know, I hear people getting up in arms about so many things. And we're about out of time for the hour, but this is one of those things that I don't see a way around this unless we address it directly and say, let's get this out of the way, then get back to the debate as usual. We got to get this immigration thing fixed. If you'd like to call us off the air, the phone number to reach us locally is 947-1111, toll free 1-800-914-PLAN. The email address are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And this is KTEM 1400, the news for Central Texas. And until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.